I am so excited to have NEJM's Editorial Fellowship Program as a sponsor for this podcast. Hear from Dr. Sarah Gorey, a current fellow, on her experiences.
I think what is really nice coming out of a clinical job, where in some ways can be quite a narrow focused viewpoint, and to come to a role like this, where you're looking at the whole of medicine, like I'm looking at studies in medicine, rheumatoid arthritis or toxicology problems, things that I don't see on a routine basis as I'm a geriatrician and I'm really focused on stroke or geriatric or cardiovascular health. There's certain things that you see a lot of, but I'm doing like, what else do I need to know about this? Or surgery, or you have such a wide range, and then it's learning that you can apply the same principles to a lot of different things, and that you kind of begin to see your own ability to apply things that you know already from one area in medicine to other areas of medicine. And it's given me great confidence from that point of view.
And this is a one-year, full-time, paid editorial fellowship. Check out the show notes for the link and learn more about the program and the application. And with that, let's get into the episode.
Diabetes is a specialty where you're really walking with your patient. You only see them once every 3 to 6 months. They're out in the real world managing their diabetes 24/7. And so if you don't include them in the medical decision-making that affects them, you're going to be at a real loss.
That's Dr. Kristen Flint, an endocrinologist at MGH. Welcome to the Core IM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. Today, we're talking about continuous glucose monitors, aka CGM, and how to titrate insulin based on CGMs. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by...
Hi, I'm Dr. Becca Easley-Mirsky, and I'm an internal medicine resident at BIDMC.
All right, let's get into it. Remember to test yourself by pausing after each of the 5 questions. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl number 1, CGM versus A1C.
What are the clinically relevant limitations to know about A1Cs versus CGMs?
Pearl number 2, ambulatory glucose profiles.
What do the different parts of the ambulatory glucose profile tell you?
Pearl number 3, high yield questions.
What are the common pitfalls, medications, and lifestyle patterns to ask your patient about before making changes to their insulin?
Pearl number 4, management of hypoglycemia with CGM.
How can you titrate insulin based on when you see the hypoglycemia on the ambulatory glucose profile?
Pearl number 5, management of hyperglycemia with CGM.
When you see too much hyperglycemia, how do you titrate the insulin, especially when adding on a GLP-1 agonist?
So I'm imagining sitting in the clinic and facing my patient who's showing me their blood sugar from the CGM app on their smartphone. But I want to take a step back. Do I care more about what number I'm being shown on their cell phone, or do I put more stock in the hemoglobin A1C?
So the A1C is reflecting the blood sugar control over the past 3 months because it's directly related to the life cycle of the red blood cell. Meanwhile, when you look at a CGM, you're looking at daily profiles or profiles for every 14 days. If a patient has made recent changes to their medications or made significant changes to their diet, their exercise levels, their lifestyle, you'll see that reflected more quickly in that 14-day measurement. You get a sense of what's going on with the blood sugar over a shorter, more recent time frame compared to the A1C, which is going to take 3 months to turn over.
So every lab test has its own limitations depending on the context, which may be the underlying theme of this episode.
Yes, what a good theme indeed. And let's get into it with A1C. To simplify A1C, it's basically measuring the glucose that's on a red blood cell. And for some good spaced repetition from our prior Mind the Gap episode on this, it's basically patient states that increase blood cell turnover, like hemolysis, blood loss. If a patient's on iron or vitamin B12 supplements, it can falsely lower the hemoglobin A1C. And the idea behind that is that in states of high cell turnover, there's just going to be less time for that glucose to hang out with that red blood cell. And so you're going to get lower A1Cs.
On the other hand, there are times where there's low blood turnover with nutritional deficiencies or hematologic malignancies, conditions where the bone marrow just isn't producing as many new cells. So there are more old red blood cells around, and they have much more time to hang out and meet up with glucose, which can falsely elevate the hemoglobin A1C.
I think our patients with renal dysfunction may be a good group to highlight. On one hand, their A1C can either be higher or lower than what's actual based on, say, if there is less cell turnover if they have concomitant iron deficiency, or at the same time, they might have higher cell turnover with EPO injections. And then on top of that, there's all these glucose shifts after dialysis that definitely are not captured by that A1C.
So for all of these reasons, in patients who have severe renal dysfunction, the CGM can help us to be much more precise about their blood sugar control.
Yes. And so we sat down with Dr. Martin, an internist at Park Nicolet Clinic and the director of the International Diabetes Center, to talk about some of the discrepancies he sees between an A1C and what he sees on a CGM.
I can think of many individual cases where, you know, maybe the A1C is at goal, you get some CGM data, it's like, oh, this is, there's way too much hypoglycemia here. And there are people who just do not meet their glucose targets. If you're looking at A1Cs, you know, we're all sort of beholden to A1C as a quality measure. But I can think of a number of individuals who have CGM data that looks essentially excellent. Their time in range looks great. Their time below range looks very good. Yet their A1C is over 8, you know, and what do you do with that? You can't really push insulin-based therapies too much harder or you're going to have hypoglycemia. You just have to live with the fact that that hemoglobin A1C may not be reflective of where this individual's at from a glucose standpoint. And don't overtreat the glucose to get your A1C below 8 if the glucose data looks really, really good based on CGM.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's lots of opportunities to get more granular trends with the CGM that aren't influenced by red blood cell turnover. But how does CGM data actually compare to the gold standard, right? How accurate is a CGM?
So that was something I was curious about as well. So I sat down with Dr. Zach Taxon, an endocrinologist at BIDMC, who gave us a sense of what percentage off the CGM may be from the actual blood glucose. And for those in the biz, this is the absolute relative difference between the serum glucose versus CGM.
But for most of the CGM devices, it's like 8 to 12%, probably in, you know, 10 to 12%. Maybe some of them are getting down to the 8 to 10% range. So that means that the relative difference between the CGM value and whatever your gold standard is, like a whole blood or usually a serum glucose, right? You're looking at an 8 to 10% on average difference for, you know, for each paired value.
So CGMs are not perfect. On the plus side, they do give us a good ballpark and give us trends without having to prick our patient's TID or QID.
And I was surprised to learn from Dr. Taxon that even our glucometers that we're so used to using in the hospital and that our patients are using all the time outpatient, that there's still a 5 to 6% difference between our point of care glucometer testing versus the gold standard serum glucose.
I did not know that. I appreciate just hearing all these comparisons because I think it hammers home that none of these machines, even our glucometers, are all of them are just not perfect and just an estimate of the truth. Okay, Becca, so back to the CGMs. I think some of that variability that we might be seeing comes probably from how the CGM measures glucose in our body.
CGM measures the glucose in the interstitial fluid between the cells. So it's not actually measuring the glucose in the blood. That glucose has to move from the bloodstream, diffuse through the vessel wall into the fluid between cells, and that's what gets measured. That takes 5 to 15 minutes for it to be measured. And so the true CGM reading is going to be delayed by 5 to 15 minutes compared to the corresponding blood glucose.
All right. So that's a great teaching point that CGMs actually lag 5 to 15 minutes. And that, I think, is something good to give patients a heads up about, especially if there's some risk of hypoglycemia, like say they're feeling woozy or lightheaded. They might actually be falsely reassured by their CGM read of their glucose, and when in reality, it might reflect something from minutes ago versus what it's actually dipped down to.
Absolutely. And there are also a few other caveats to give patients a heads up about when interpreting their glucose numbers on a CGM.
So first, some of the CGMs will be less accurate over the first 24 hours. And so I tell a lot of my patients, the CGM is going to be great, but the first 24 hours might not look quite right. So if you have any concerns about high blood sugar or low blood sugar, or you're having symptoms, just do a finger stick to confirm. Usually after the first day, things are pretty stable.
I mean, a pretty common one is, so pressure on the area, which compresses the space or reduces the blood flow, you know, or alters the dynamics of the interstitial space, you know, or actually just injures the device itself. Those can obviously cause pretty significant errors. The other very common one is when you insert the device, if you nick a very superficial, small, like venule or even capillary, sometimes there's a little blood there, it can clot, and then you're not going to get accurate readings.
And other fun facts you might hear are that high doses of vitamin C or Tylenol can affect the CGM accuracy. But when we looked into it, super high doses of vitamin C, greater than 500 milligrams, that's like 10 oranges, which I don't know. I love oranges, but I haven't seen someone eat 10 oranges.
Or Tylenol in doses greater than 1 gram at one time or greater than 4 grams per day are also associated with inaccurate readings, but we may want to avoid those doses anyway.
Exactly. All right. We have covered some good ground here. Let's summarize. Continuous glucose monitors give us a granular data of the trends in the blood sugar that we might not uncover with just an A1C. And CGM is a tool, like a lot of these, and is not perfect. There is a warm-up period for the first 24 hours or so, and then there's about a 10% variation from the patient's actual serum glucose, and there is a lag of, say, 5 to 15 minutes. Now onto the very quick and practical dive of how to interpret these CGMs.
So say a patient has a CGM that either you prescribed or they were able to purchase over the counter, and they say, hey, want to look at it? And you're like, yes, of course. But then you go to take a look at the app and you're like, wow, there's so much data. Where do I even start?
Yes, exactly. And the best thing to look at is the ambulatory glucose profile, which is downloadable and most clinics have accounts to access.
So there's three sections of the ambulatory glucose profile, and we'll go through each of the sections one by one, and you can follow along in the show graphic. The first section gives the percentage of time a patient is in range. The green part is the time in range, yellow is the time above range, and red is the time below range.
And the top part, the yellow part, is the time above range. And so just in 10 seconds, what I do is I take a look at this top portion, the metric. Is the time in range at goal? Is the time below range too high? And so what's that goal? Time in range, that's time with a glucose between 70 and 180 milligrams per deciliter. You want that to be over 70% of your day. And why 70% of the day? Because very loosely, that correlates with an A1C around 7%. And so 70% time in range, you want to get above that if you can.
So ideally, we want to see that green part of the ambulatory glucose profile say 70% of the time they're in range, or I'm sure we're also happy if they're in range more than 70% of the time, but that's basically saying their glucose is between 70 to 180 milligrams per deciliter at least 70% of the time.
And the caveat to that 70% threshold that our reviewers pointed out is in older patients. Older patients just have higher risk of hypoglycemia, so we are more relaxed about their goals. And so we're okay if older patients' time in range is between 50 and 70% so that they have a little bit more leeway.
That is a great point that all these thresholds of 70% time range is you know, just a rule of thumb. And our patient in front of us, especially the elderly, might have different thresholds. So let's move on now to the time below range, the red part. We want to be less than 4%.
Obviously, you might say, well, don't we want the time below range to be zero? And, you know, we sort of do in real terms. If you look at a glucose profile for somebody with no diabetes, a normal glycemic response, you see time below 70. So that's maybe 1.1% of the time if you look at a population-based study. And so people can drop below 70. It's not dangerous. We worry about it in diabetes because if you're treating people with agents that can cause hypoglycemia, which is insulin, sulfonylurea therapy, you want to minimize it because we worry that you're going to drop further than 70, right? So 4% is the threshold. You want to be under 4%.
So the reason why the target time below range is not 0% is because in the real world, people do drift below 70 all the time. And so some dips are accepted and I guess expected.
And if you pop over to the right of the ambulatory glucose, you'll find a line called the Glucose Management Index, aka GMI, which gives an estimate of the A1C based on the last 14 days. And this can help with patient counseling, particularly if they're very used to using A1C for feedback and giving them an idea of what their A1C would look like based on the last 14 days.
So that GMI is just a number, estimate of what their A1C is. But then the second section, the middle section of the ambulatory glucose profile, this is going to give you the glucose trends of the last 14 days merged all together in a 24-hour timeline.
And so we're looking at the modal day view, the ambulatory glucose profile view. We're looking at patterns. There's a median line. There's margins, the 95 and 5% line. And we're seeing if there's a pattern to hypoglycemia, if there's a pattern to hyperglycemia, because those are targets for intervention.
So that middle part lets us ask the question, what does a typical day look like for this patient? Do they have morning hypoglycemia? Are they having postprandial hyperglycemia? Or typically, are they low at nighttime?
So the third and bottom section is the daily glucose profile, which is a snapshot of each of those 14 days. So you get a better idea of, are they having more hyperglycemia on the weekends? Or were there a few days of significant hyperglycemia? And was that possibly around a sickness or some other life event? So now that we've reached the bottom of the ambulatory glucose profile, let's summarize. I think this section was new learning for me. I learned to not be intimidated when someone gives you their phone, and it empowered me to find the ambulatory glucose profile. I look at the time and range to target 70% for the green time and range section, which correlates to an A1C of 7%. And then most importantly, to look to see that the time below range is less than 4%.
Yeah. And then if you go lower down in the ambulatory glucose profile, you get really good information about certain times of the day the patient might be higher or lower than what we'd like. And then we can also look at the full 14 days in a week and find, are there certain days that the patient may be particularly off their goal? I am so excited to have Echo Core 500 Digital Stethoscope as a sponsor. I actually learned about them accidentally a year or so ago when I'd forgotten my stethoscope and my resident let me borrow his, and I just was like, wow, I've never heard heart sounds or lung sounds this clearly. You just get this extra level of confidence for those moments where you're asking, was that faint crackles? Was that an S3 gallop? And so that's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies sounds 40x, and then on top of that, it has noise cancellation so you can really hear with precision in a noisy ED or with a really loud roommate or other environments. Echo AI is also built in and helps you detect murmurs and AFib earlier. A cool thing also is that you can record that heart sound that you heard, share it later with your team, or on a case presentation. And then you can really trust the diagnostic accuracy. It's backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for the devices and the AI algorithms. So those who use Echo are twice as likely to catch heart disease. What I think is neat is that Echo 500 isn't just the digital stethoscope. You can actually also get an EKG tracing right on the app when you place an Echo 500 on a patient's chest. So no more waiting around trying to trace down the EKG machine on the floor. I trust Echo so much that I work with a team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/corium. Your purchase will be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you're going to detect heart and lung sounds more confidently. And if you don't, you can return it with a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/corium for $50 off plus a free chest cover. That's ekohealth.com/corium. And with that, let's get back into the episode. A quick word from our sponsor, Washington Red Raspberries. These days, it's easy to not really know where our food actually came from, but there's something really grounding to knowing the story behind what's on your plate. I recently learned that 90% of American-grown frozen red raspberries comes from a tight-knit group of family farmers in Washington state, generations of families who've dedicated their lives to growing berries with care, and it shows. These raspberries are frozen right at peak ripeness, which means every time I toss it into a smoothie after a long shift or sprinkle into some yogurt, they taste just as fresh as the day they were picked. No additives, just pure, real flavor and nutrition. You can find frozen Washington red raspberries in the frozen fruit section of most major grocery retailers. You can check the label and see quote-unquote products of the U.S. It's also pretty popular products like Smucker's raspberry jam or the Smucker's Uncrustables with the red raspberry filling. To learn more and hear the stories of the farmers behind these incredible berries, head to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. There's also recipes as well as the retailers that carry these delicious berries. So check out the link in the show notes. And with that, let's get back into the episode. All right. So now before we go ahead and make any changes to the patient's insulin based on them being too high or too low, let us put our investigative hat on. This is like my favorite section and makes me always feel like a good doctor when I uncover these things before making med changes.
I really love this part, and we really kind of got into this in the last Pearl. When we see certain trends, we can ask, what's going on at nighttime when your sugars go low? And when's your last meal?
Right. Or if we're seeing sugars higher on the weekends, we can ask about life stressors that might be going on Saturdays or Sundays.
And this really is the beauty of medicine and continuous glucose monitors, is that we get to learn about each patient's patterns.
I have another patient who came in to see me actually last week, and she said, I'm having really high sugars after meals. So we looked at her CGM, and sure enough, after she ate, she would have a blood sugar of 300, and it would last for a couple of hours. Then it would come down. And so I asked her what she was doing with her insulin. And she said, well, I was eating my entire meal and then taking the insulin, because that's what they told me to do in the hospital. In the hospital, they never knew how much she was going to eat, and so they had to see what she ate before they covered it. Sometimes we do the best that we can in the hospital, but it's not quite right. In the outpatient setting, because she was taking the insulin late, she was having the carbs peak, and the insulin wasn't even active yet. So we were seeing the sugars get up to 300, and then it took some time for the insulin to work, but when it did, it brought down her blood sugar. So I said, okay, why don't you try to move the insulin administration up to 5, 10, 15 minutes before you eat, and we'll see if that helps your blood sugars instead of just going up on the insulin dose. And sure enough, in looking at her CGM, I can see that now her blood sugars are much better controlled with the meals, all because we moved the timing of the insulin. And so even though you can get daytime hyperglycemia, nighttime hypoglycemia, unless you talk to the patient about what they're doing, you're not going to know what to do.
Oof, what a great point about diabetes management is really about walking with your patient and then literally just asking your patient, walk me through how you're taking insulin and not just jumping to treat the numbers.
I mean, you have to think through your troubleshooting, put on your internal medicine hat. Is that expired insulin? Insulin does go bad, sort of a fragile protein, you know, so if it freezes, if it heats up in the summer, sometimes it loses activity. If it's expired, it loses activity. And so perhaps it's expired insulin. Maybe there's something else going on. Acute illness will often cause a rise in glucose values. Lipohypertrophy, if you inject insulin in the same site over and over, insulin is an anabolic hormone, basically. So what you will get is you get fat buildup. And that is called lipohypertrophy. The problem with lipohypertrophy, aside from having a lump there cosmetically, is that if you're injecting insulin into that, it's not real vascular. The insulin doesn't get absorbed right, and you start to get variability in absorption or not absorption. And so rotating sites is important.
Yes, the differential we should be thinking of is, how is the insulin being stored? Is the insulin expired? Was there an illness? Are you rotating the insulin injection site?
Yes. And the other thing that I love asking about, especially when I see hypoglycemia, is asking about alcohol use.
Fun fact, alcohol can actually increase your insulin sensitivity. And on top of that, alcohol curbs the liver's ability to counter-regulate the hypoglycemia.
No fun. And that could be good to kind of uncover before making some changes. And then I think last but not least, in terms of important high-yield questions to investigate, is of course lifestyle changes, right? Diet and exercise. Have there been any changes? Because these CGMs are giving you kind of the last 2 weeks or so. And kind of a personal story on this note, I actually gave my family members as a Christmas gift, CGMs. And it was so great for them to have their own aha moment about Indian foods that have been passed down as highly proteinaceous, right? But in fact, like, spikes their glucose up so fast. And I just love that they had the chance to be open to making food changes before jumping to med changes.
So yes, CGMs are much more powerful information than the family WhatsApp group or Instagram reels that they might be getting information from. Let's refresh what we just covered. To summarize, the next time you see a patient with significant abnormalities on their ambulatory glucose profile, do pause and ask the patient, how are they taking their insulin? Could there be a mix-up with their mealtime or basal insulin? Are they refrigerating their insulin? Is it expired? Could alcohol be playing a factor into their hypoglycemic episodes? And most importantly, ask them about any changes in their diet or activities that it could explain any changes that you're seeing in the last 14 days.
All right, now onto the actual management with all the information that we're getting from the CGMs. I think the first and foremost, we have to make sure our patients are safe. So the first thing is looking over to that time in red section and seeing, is this patient in the red more than 4% of the time? Are they hypoglycemic more than 4% of the time? And taking action on that.
I think most of these CGMs have alarms set at 54 that you can't turn off appropriately. You know, you want people to know that and act on that if they're drifting down. One of the problems with hypoglycemia is that if people are having frequent hypoglycemia, they start to lose their perception of hypoglycemia. They start to develop hypoglycemic unawareness. And the big risk for hypoglycemic unawareness is hypoglycemia. Your glucose meter in your brain resets itself and you just don't feel or perceive the symptoms as you start to drift down.
And so that brings us to the first branch point in the management of hypoglycemia. If you're seeing hypoglycemia, then you have to ask if they're on a sulfonylurea. And if they are, that sulfonylurea has to go.
Yes, hard. Do not pass go if the patient's still taking glipizide or glimepiride and their sugars are low. But Becca, say our patient is not on a sulfonylurea and is on insulin, but having hypoglycemia more than 4% of the time. What do we go about changing, right? Do we do the basal insulin, the mealtime insulin? What's the approach here?
And this is where peeking over at the bottom of the ambulatory glucose profile is so helpful. We need to see when in the day the low sugars are happening. Is it happening at night, or is it a specific time of the day, or throughout both the day and the night?
Yeah, such good questions. And why don't we tackle each of those scenarios? Let's say our patient is having sugars that dip overnight, say 11 p.m. or later, or having low fasting morning glucoses.
Keep an eye out for too much basal insulin, over basalization. You know, again, you can see that pattern with big exaggerated drop overnight, typically a rise during the day because people aren't being adequately treated for their mealtime needs. So watch for over basalization or too much basal insulin.
All right, let's break that down a bit because I've definitely fallen into this trap. I didn't know what it was called. So oftentimes when we see patients, say after meals, they're having hyperglycemia, we often respond by increasing their basal insulin sometimes because of that postprandial hyperglycemia. However, sometimes that basal insulin is increased too much, and too much basal insulin can leave patients low at nighttime.
And as a rule of thumb, over-basalization usually happens when the basal insulin exceeds greater than 0.5 units per kilogram per day.
That's really high yield, 0.5 units per kilogram per day. I'll definitely keep that in mind in the future. So the takeaway here is that if the patient's glucose is low at nighttime or fasting in the morning, and you suspect there's too much basal insulin on board, you want to go down on the basal insulin and then tackle the postprandial highs separately, which we're going to get all into in Pearl 5.
But the diagnostic pause that we all need to do as a throwback to Pearl 3 is to check in with the patient about what's been going on. Do they have an alarm going off often at night because they're sleeping on it?
You do get artifacts sometimes. You're sleeping on a sensor, you're sleeping on your arm. That pressure can sometimes be enough to cause the glucose usually to drift down because you're forcing all the interstitial fluid out from around the sensor, so it's not reading accurately.
Oh, such a good throwback before jumping to be like, oh my gosh, your sugars are so low. All right, Becca, let's get to the other two scenarios. Say you're reviewing that middle bottom portion of that ambulatory glucose profile, and you're seeing the patient's low sugars are happening at a particular part of the day, say in the afternoon.
So if the low glucose happens at a specific time of the day, we can reduce the mealtime bolus dose that is happening right before that time. So you can consider reducing the mealtime dose by around 10%, which is the rule of thumb that Dr. Martins uses and teaches with.
And of course, there are many approaches to insulin adjustment and what may be appropriate for the patient in front of you, but 10% is just a rule that many do.
frequent small adjustments. If you're working with somebody with insulin, think about maybe 10% adjustment to one of the insulins. Think about revisiting that profile in 2 weeks or so.
I really appreciate virtual visits or electronic messaging, and I really feel that it's great for getting those frequent touch points and doing these small adjustments. It's both safe and patient-friendly.
Yes, bless those virtual touch points. All right, last scenario of hypoglycemia is an unfortunate case where we're seeing lows throughout the day and night. I don't think I've seen too much of this, but how will you approach it?
Yeah, if we're seeing lows throughout, then we decrease the total daily insulin dose. So basically decreasing a bit of the basal as well as the mealtime doses.
So let's recap what we've learned so far. Next time I see a patient's ambulatory glucose profile with their time below range, the red part, more than 4%, I will go over to the med list and see if they're on a sulfonylurea. And if they are, I will make sure that medication is stopped before touching their insulin. And then I'll pull up the ambulatory glucose profile and try to pinpoint when exactly those lows are happening. I think the big teaching point for me with this section was the trap of over-basalization. And this happens particularly when I see those postprandial spikes happening and then the patient's sugars are low at nighttime or their fasting morning is low. Then I should try to reduce the basal insulin and tackle the postprandial high separately, which we'll talk about in Pearl 5. And then, Becca, the great point that you taught was that over-basalization usually happens when the basal insulin is greater than 0.5 units per kilogram per day.
Exactly. And if I'm noticing lows at a specific time of day, I'll reduce the mealtime bolus that comes right before it. And then in the other scenario, if you're seeing lows scattered throughout both the day and the night, I'll decrease their total daily insulin dose.
So now that we've talked about the lows, let's talk about where we find most of our patients is having too much of the yellow, time above range with their sugars over 180, and not enough of the green, right? The time in range. And as a reminder, this is going to be somebody whose time in range is less than 70%. So less than 70% of the time, the patient is having a sugar of 70 to 180 that we like to see.
What I was surprised to learn is that the first step isn't insulin adjustments. It's to add on a GLP-1 agonist like semaglutide or the dual GIP-GLP-1 receptor agonist like tirzepatide.
Yes, and because it's a mouthful to say both GLP-1 and the GIP-GLP-1 receptor agonist, we're just going to say GLP agonist for short. So these medicines are both effective for fasting hyperglycemia as well as postprandial hyperglycemias. And of course, not to mention there's all these cardiovascular benefits. And it's crazy to think that now GLP-1s are recommended even before adding on insulin.
There's certainly less risk of hypoglycemia and less titration with GLP-1s that makes it much more patient-friendly for treatment.
And maybe clinician-friendly too, right? So let's walk through some of these scenarios. Let's say our patient is already on insulin therapy and now needs a GLP-1 agonist.
That's a great question. I'd be worried about the GLP-1's effect on enhanced insulin secretion, less glucagon production, especially when they already have insulin on board, and then anticipating the changes in my patient's appetite and diet when they start these medications.
So if they have an A1C of 8 or less or a time in range of 50% or more, I typically will reduce the insulin dose by 20% as I add the GLP-1. If they're less tightly controlled, if their A1C is over 8, time in range is under 50%, I typically just add the GLP-1. You're typically adding the GLP-1 at its lowest dose because you have to start low and titrate up. And so we're reducing if they're close to goal because we don't want to precipitate hypoglycemia even with adding the lowest dose of a GLP-1. And then as we do our titration steps with the GLP-1 therapy, we're going to want to be revisiting where we're at with insulin therapy because typically we're backing off on insulin, often pretty dramatically.
So to recap, if a patient's glucose is not well controlled, say their time in range is less than 50%, then you can feel comfortable just adding on the GLP-1 to the existing insulin regimen and watching closely. But if their time in range is 50 to 70% and you're adding on a GLP-1, we should also back off on the total daily insulin by at least 20% or so, with, of course, keeping a close eye on those sugars.
They tend to really damp down the postprandial spikes. And so sometimes if you're on basal and bolus insulin, you got to keep an eye on that mealtime insulin. And so if we can use basal insulin plus a GLP-1 in place of mealtime insulin, that is typically a win.
Oh man, that is such a win if our patients could just simplify their regimen to a basal insulin and then once weekly injections of one of the GLP-1 agonists. That genuinely brings a smile to my face just to think about. But switching gears, I think the reality is that there are people out there who might not be candidates for a GLP-1. Maybe their insurance doesn't cover it, or they can't tolerate it with GI side effects. How do we go about titrating their insulin based on seeing a lot of hyperglycemia on their CGM?
So for patients who cannot take a GLP-1 and still continue to have significant hyperglycemia, the approach that Dr. Martins takes really depends on their current time and range. So if they're not well controlled, so say a time and range is less than 50% and they're only on basal insulin, we can consider adding mealtime insulin.
More injections for our patients, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But say our patients are already on a basal bolus insulin regimen and they're still not well controlled and their time and range is less than 50%.
So Dr. Martins recommended that if they're already on basal bolus therapy with time and range less than 50%, we'd increase their total daily insulin dose by 10%. Again, emphasizing that slow and steady approach to insulin management. And that 10% increase in insulin gets redistributed to maintain a 50-50 balance between both the basal and the bolus insulins.
You're going to want to advise people, you know, if you're seeing a lot of lows, I want to know about that. Give me a call. We'll troubleshoot it. We'll adjust your insulin more. And so as you're titrating, you want to be revisiting where you're at with your glucoses. And CGM makes it a little easier because you can pull up your website and see where they're at and do a lot of that even remotely.
And as for spaced repetition, in our older patients who are at higher risk of hypoglycemia, we're much more relaxed about goals and we're okay with a time and range of 50 to 70%. So they have more leeway with their blood sugars.
Yeah, that's also another good spaced repetition about our older patients. All right, so to summarize one approach to hyperglycemia, again, each patient is also so different. First is to consider adding or optimizing the GLP-1 receptor agonist or the dual GIP-GLP-1 that they're already on before making major insulin adjustments. And if you're adding these agents and their time and range is 50 to 70%, then you should reduce that basal insulin or total daily dose by 20%. And if their time in range is below 50%, so they're really not well controlled, just keep that insulin the same and feel free to add on that GLP-1 with a very close follow-up.
For patients who can't use weekly GLP-1 injections and are not as well controlled, say time in range less than 50%, we can either add mealtime insulin or increase total daily dose by 10%. And most important is to maintain close follow-up, preferably after 2 weeks, to just continually reassess and make adjustments as needed.
Yes, bless. Frequent virtual visits, if possible. All right, so that is a wrap for our episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you got some value from this podcast, our ask is to please share it with at least one other colleague who might also get something from this episode.
And thank you to our reviewers, Dr. Jonathan Lee and Dr. Michael Weintraub. Thank you to Dr. Jesse Powell for the accompanying graphics. This episode was made as part of the digital education track at BIDMC.
Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions.
Lowe's knows you want the best for dad. This Father's Day, help him take on any project with big deals on DeWalt. Right now, get a free XR 8 amp hour battery when you buy select DeWalt tools. That's not all. Get up to 2 free select tools when you buy a select DeWalt 20 volt max battery kit. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a work load is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.